Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sensual toe tapping up your streets. Hello and welcome to This Is 8CD. My name is Jerry Scullion and I'm a designer, educator and I'm the host of This Is 8CD based in the wonderful city of Dublin, Ireland. Now our goal here is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organisations to become more human-centred in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. Now, this is a new type of episode that I'm looking to explore more over the coming years, and that is looking laterally into other fields where we as change makers can find inspiration. And inspiration is hopefully what you're about to feel and hear in this conversation with one of the finest singer-songwriters around today, and that is Mark Geary. Now, the music you hear throughout this episode is from Mark's first album released in 2002, and has accompanied me on my journey as a designer and an expatriate whilst living in Australia. It wasn't until recently, though, that we got to sit face to face in front of a turf stove, drinking countless coffees and singing and playing guitar together in Mark's gorgeous cottage in the wilds of a rainy autumn day, deep within a forest on the outskirts of Dublin City. And in this conversation, we chat about the remarkable journey that Mark has been on for over the last two decades that has seen him play all over the world countless times. Mark doesn't play music to be adored, though. He really plays to exist, and hopefully that comes across in this episode. It's really part of who he is. It's part of his fabric. He constantly tours around the world, often with Glenn Hansard, another phenomenally talented Irish musician who lives close by. Now, we speak about his roots in Shinnay, in New York, a place where he cut his teeth. It was a free-flowing cafe that many music lovers will automatically connect probably with Jeff Buckley. But this was a community of like-minded people that you're going to hear more of Mark talking about, that really cheered and nurtured their own. A community much like our own within This Is 8CD that is trying to figure it all out and get ahead. Now, there are points in this conversation where we chat about Mark's environment and how having the space set up and ready to channel whatever it is that we call it and how it affects the process. Mark's guitars are all around the place. He's got notebooks everywhere. He's constantly playing. He's experimenting, he's trying, and he's testing out ideas. He is, at his core, a master craftsperson. We even talk about how this environment is shaping his music, or maybe it's his music that is shaping his environment. How living within a forest is permeating his latest release, with his latest single being called The Forest. So let's get into it. Mark Geary, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer, and This Is 8CD. I'm delighted to be here with you. I'm sitting in your front room of your beautiful cottage in County Kildare in Ireland with the log fire and the turf fire going. A long-time admirer of your work, Mark. Maybe start off by telling our listeners a little bit about who you are and what's your background.
Okay. Now, I have to say that all of this is a movie set. None of this really exists. When you leave, we'll just knock
evaporate.
It down, and yeah, I'll go back to my high-rise apartment. I'm a musician. I guess I've been playing for most of my life. I'm a father. What else am I? I'm a traveler. I'm a seeker, I suppose. Ask myself a lot of questions, ask other people a lot of questions. But a musician, I suppose, is the reason we're having this chat.
Yeah.
But I'm lots of things.
You know? You're lots of things.
Yeah.
You're a creator.
Yeah, it's you know, music was the thing that happened first, and it's the thing that it's such a comfort, it's such a comfortable little jumper. I never was a painter. I never was a. They say that everyone has a book in them. I wonder about that, but music is the thing that excited me. I think, you know, just to listen, just to be taken away on that little,
yeah,
on that little bus ride, you know.
It's crazy. When we were chatting earlier about doing this episode together, I mentioned about 2002 or 2003, maybe, I think it was, the launch party of your first album. Maybe I'll take you back to that point in 2002, and maybe a couple of years before that. You know, we mentioned that you were coming from London and you went to New York.
Yeah.
Take me back to that time. What was Mark Geary like back then in those stages? What was he afraid? What was he afraid of?
Oh, Mark then was afraid of everything. I'm pretty certain. When I lived in New York, I kept hearing a phrase that even if you were frightened, you know, you just show up. Face the fear and just do it anyway. I kept hearing that. Mm. So there was a moment in London when I was a young teenager. There was Bristol. There was a girlfriend in Bristol, and then back to school, and a kind of a realization that it wasn't really working. Whether they said that to me or whether I admitted that to them. My brother had this place called the Chine Cafe that maybe yeah. your listeners might be aware of. So that was one of at least 100 that I would be aware of cafes that had music.
Yeah.
There was nothing really about Chine that should have made it stand out or catapulted into like 20, 30 years later, our still conversation. You know, there's nothing about it. There was no stage. There was no real plan. Every night, people just kind of showed up and no tickets and no, you know, it wasn't Eventbrite or any of that kind of stuff. And I do marvel. I do marvel at, like, my brother Carl, who lives in Glasgow now and is a writer, and he had his own journey of, you know, bar owner, demolition, you know, fucking working on a crew, doing all that, you know, was an actor for a while, and essentially kind of retreated into this dream that he had, that I still remember. When we were sitting in our front room, me playing four strings and a guitar, and Carl with a notebook that he'd bought a fortune, spent a fortune on a notebook.
This is in when you were in New York or when you were younger?
When we were kids in Dublin. But I have to kind of tip my hat to those two kids that somehow, with all of the turns and the jigs and the reels, I kind of continued on that. Like Carl was successful as a bar owner and whatever. But as far as joy or something that kind of nurtured him or he just kind of rejected it all. Mm. And so he's writing and his second novel is done. And
wow.
So it's beautiful stuff. And it's like I realized just with Carl that he's writing and I'm singing songs kind of about the same things, you know?
Let me take you back a little bit further to your childhood then, because it's unusual, or maybe it is usual, to have two creative offspring in a family, like, you know?
Yeah.
What was the formative years of your childhood like, in terms of, like, you're a musician, a writer, a creator, as we said, and he's also followed a creative path.
Well, we're the two youngest of a family of 10.
Right, okay.
My dad was a bricklayer.
Yeah.
So, not to paint any kind of picture that is untrue, but, you know, culture, or there's that great line, where I come from, art is short for Arthur. You know, it was survival. It was subsistence. Yeah. It was, you know, like so many kids and just cold and cornflakes and get out to school and
get on with it, just do
the best you can. Whatever madness is going on there, don't bring it home. I think that's what it was. So how or why did I have that yearning? I mean, you're a musician too. Why, like, what's that awakening? Yeah. I remember a big stereo in the good room in Ireland. There was a good room.
Yeah.
The coldest place in the house. No one was ever in there. It was like a museum.
Yeah.
But there was this big stereo that was bought on HP, higher purchase, the drip, as we'd call it in Dublin. Yeah. And I snuck in there every night and would put the speakers in such a way that I'd lie back and be in the middle of it. Yeah. And I know for certain that no one else was doing that.
Yeah.
And to me, it seemed like the only thing you should be doing, the only sensible thing was to sneak into this stereo and under penalty of death, if you were caught, you know, press all these buttons. And then I remember there was a thing I found at the back. I'm not very electronic and I'm not very techie.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a kind of an intuitive kind of techie. I found this button at the back that I was able to record into this stereo on a tape. And then someone gave me a microphone and I literally was demoing.
Lights went off.
The lights went off. And it wasn't that like, oh my God, I'm going to open a studio or whatever.
Yeah.
It was just that I was going to hear my voice and I was going to try.
You could hear it back.
I was going to listen back to, you know, well, that's okay, or that's awful. Maybe I could try to do something better. Or how do you, like, what is better? Like, how do you get better, you know?
And what kind of music were you listening to back then? Like, what was available to you, like, from your your older siblings?
Like,
that you
really, really, some really appalling stuff. Because LPs were
expensive.
A fortune.
Yeah.
I had a brother-in-law, Peter, have a brother-in-law, Peter, who was a bit of a hippie.
Mm.
And he kind of, I guess he saw he was my Yoda. I guess he saw kind of a kindred spirit when it came to music. And he would drop down some LPs, treasured LPs. Like, so Dylan shows up but if Dylan didn't show up, it would have been Chris de Burgh or...
Yeah. Don't ever pay that ferry, man.
No. Yeah. And it was Blade all the art, like Meatloaf and, you know, whatever it was. Well, my brothers, bless them.
Yeah.
They used to say, is that a real song or one you wrote yourself, you know?
This was early 80s then, was it?
Mid-80s. And then did I find musicians? Maybe I had robbed a guitar or got some kind of guitar. I remember my sister came back with a guitar from Spain. You know, you bought a sombrero and a donkey, and a Spanish guitar. It was just not that you'd ever play it, but you'd bring it back as a thing. And I remember very seriously, kind of just trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
And we were talking about Waltons and your old employers. I would walk up to Dunleary. Because you couldn't get the bus because you didn't have the money. So you'd walk up to Dunleary and kind of look at songbooks of Dylan songs and Beatles and Neil Young and Nick Drake and whatever. And you'd look.
Remember the chords.
And try scribble down tunings. I became aware that there was a standard tuning and then there's other tunings you can mess around with or whatever.
The Secret Doors, as I said.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's funny, like if that was the mid-80s, then there was kind of an era in Irish music towards the late 80s. Obviously U2 and you know, there was a whole host of bands, Cactus World News and a bunch of them way back then. But as we were mentioning before there, it was probably around 93 or 94 when I first heard Radiohead and I was just like, wow, okay, this is a little bit different. And at the same time, underneath that pile of CDs my sister gave me was the Frames DC, as they were known then. And it was a single of, I'm trying to remember the name of the single. It wasn't Revelate. It was one of the ones before that.
Like The Dancer or
something like that. I remember, you know, it cost about a pound to get it.
Sure.
And I remember casually tuning into FM 104 from Drogheda and hearing that the Frames were going to be on late at night, and rang in. And I would have been 14 at the time or 15. And Glenn was being interviewed. And at this stage, The Commitments has probably happened, 91. And I remember rang up and I may as well have been getting through to U2. And I had to answer the name of the question, what was their first single? And Glenn was like, fair play, tickets to, shouldn't do an impression, you got tickets to the Midnight at the Olympia. And I was like, next problem, how am I going to get to Midnight at the Olympia from Drogheda? But I did it, and I'd seen the Frames many, many times. So in that era, where were you, and what were you doing in that kind of, the sort of dawning of a new kind of range of Irish music, where suddenly we were no longer second.
Where
best.
Was I was gone.
You were gone. You were in London at that stage.
I was in New York.
You're in New York. So you were over there in New York at that stage.
Yeah.
And you had a guitar.
I sold guitars to get the one-way ticket.
Right. Okay. So you had no guitar in New York at that stage.
I had nothing.
So walk me through what happens from then. You mentioned Sinné there at the start of the 2000s. Yeah. How did you end up writing one of the albums that I still hold very dear to my heart, 33 and a Third? How did that come about? Like, if you didn't have a guitar, what was your materials as a craftsperson at that stage?
My eyes and my I was a sponge.
Mm.
And I got to New York and Sinné was in its pomp.
Yeah.
And
you saw Jeff Buckley as well, of course.
Well, Jeff was, if I can describe what Sinné really was, I mean, you know, the most appalling coffee that has ever been created and illegal.
Yeah.
Because the machine that it was made from just wasn't fit for purpose.
Yeah.
And but it was cheap. So Shane Doyle and Carl, my brother, had opened this place. And in the daytime, it almost felt like the Irish embassy.
Right.
And when I said at the start, like, there's no reason why this cafe
succeeded.
Should have succeeded. One of its charms, and one of the charms, as difficult as it is to talk about Irish people in my own people as a flattering light, we do greeting and people management really, really well.
Yeah.
There's an ease and a charm that honestly, in my years of traveling, we are so disarming.
Mm.
We're bonkers, but we're so disarming. And we're very interested in making people kind of comfortable and welcome if we so choose, you know.
Yeah.
So Sinead's charm in the daytime when there's no music on, with the shitty coffee and the lousy sandwiches and whatever, and air filled with smoke because you could smoke then.
Yeah.
Was just heads sitting around and chatting. And there was lots of East Village kind of musicians, Americans and the like. Mm. Because New York is a foster home for all of America as well.
Yeah.
You go to either coast, you go to LA, you go to New York.
Yeah.
So there were all these kind of orphans, you know, in New York who were looking for something. So there was
kindred spirits and tribes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, you want to go somewhere where you open the door. It's a bit like Cheers. You want to walk in somewhere where people are going to wave at you and acknowledge you. New York is a lonely, lonesome place at night. And if you know that you can go somewhere, I just want to pop in here. I used to see people when I bartended, they'd hit maybe unthinkable here in Ireland or Dublin, you know, but they on your night out. And I don't mean drinking shit face drunk. I mean, just on your night out.
Yeah.
I would go to maybe 10 places.
Yeah.
On a walk. And, you know, the East Village is tiny, but in the space of five blocks, I would, you know, we would go see that band of Brownies. I'd go down to the sidewalk where I used to do my open mic. I'd go to, you know, an abundance of coffee, sit on a stoop outside, talk to the manager, have a cigarette, go meet this guy, meet another dude walking on the street. It was a walk, like you didn't live in your apartment. You slept in your apartment.
Yeah.
You
lived outdoors.
But there's nothing in the apartment. It was kind of like this tiny little bedsit. That's really what it was.
Absolutely.
So everything else is at your doorstep. So go out. And then it felt nice to be playing and whatever. But Shanae was that. So in the daytime, all of these kindred spirits, and I just asked a lot of questions and was really curious. And there were really, really witty people. There was a friend of mine, Adam Roth, it's kind of older than me and really fabulous dresser and like movie references, constant imitations of, you know, classic Bogart. You know, he just had this font of cultural references.
Charisma.
And charisma.
Yeah.
And he was a musician. He played amazing guitar. And so we talk about this notion of attraction rather than promotion, you know?
Yeah.
And all of these guys had it. I was really just wanted to hang out with these. So pre-Mark, certainly pre-record, but pre-Mark with no gigs and no guitar, that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
I was drinking a lot of coffee and paying attention and going to movies and going to, like, I became
being
a sponge.
Absorbed. Yeah,
absolutely.
Absorbing everything.
Absolutely.
What can you remember? Like, the Shanae thing is something that I could easily glaze over, but it just seems like, and I associate you as being a product of that era, like, still to this day, because...
Yeah. I think I am.
Yeah.
I think I am.
Yeah,
like, I certainly, as they say in New York, I cut my teeth there.
Exactly.
And I do remember failing there, I must say.
Yeah.
Like there wasn't balloons and confetti when I played. I remember failing there.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it came from that I would get such a kicking, and I mean a fucking kicking, at a gig. Like just nobody cared.
Yeah. So playing in Shanae at that time.
There's no money. It's
rock up, do your thing.
Yeah.
Hopefully you
win a crowd.
Yeah. Do it the hard way.
Yeah.
You know, people are chatting, people are talking.
Eating and important, because everything that New Yorkers do is important.
What did you learn to win a crowd back then? Because, like, if you're cutting your teeth, that's one of the things you need to be able to silence them and get their attention.
Yeah. It's a funny one, and I will answer it, but there is this kind of idea. There is this notion of kind of having to win a crowd.
Mm.
You know, maybe that's where we are in the world, but winning the crowd, meaning in some way doing it for a way that's pleasing to an audience.
Yeah.
Who is this audience? Are they an audience that...
They want to be won.
Do they want to be won? But what are their tastes? Are they McDonald's? Do they like McDonald's? Are they sushi people?
Yeah, true.
You know, like, are you... Not to consider it kind of debasement or whatever, but I've wrestled with the idea of winning a crowd.
Yeah.
Like, how about the fucking crowd just pay attention to me, and I know what I do.
Yeah.
So wouldn't it be nice maybe if they
know what they need to do?
Yeah. And then a crowd could say, well, go fuck yourself. We want this.
Yeah.
We want that color blue, and we want you to sing this kind of thing.
Exactly.
And so it's an incredible, and at every gig, it is that kind of meeting of, there's something kind of beautiful and challenging about not meeting of the minds.
I know. So that album then, if you were prototyping, I guess, the songs, you were testing them out effectively in those early stages.
I had to write them. I had to, you know, so, you know, 90, 92, 93, 94. I struck on this... Also, in my life, I was there was melancholy and there was kind of there were different kind of conversations that I was hearing. There was an appraisal of one's background, or an appraisal of who I was or who one was. I heard people write about songs like that. I heard hey, I'm from here and we do it, you know. And you know, we talked before we started about an expatriate.
Yeah.
And what that could mean. And I remember If I Should Fall From Grace With God, the Pogues album.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously Fairy Tale in New York is the monster on that. But Thousands Are Sailing, the song by Phil Chevron. We walked hand in hand on Broadway like the first men on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back to my empty room, I suppose I must have cried. Like, here was a guy singing about an expatriate's kind of kind of jovial, the kind of the Irish guy who's like the life of the party, but goes back to a bedsit on his own and kind of sobs himself to sleep.
Yeah.
That's not an inaccurate kind of picture of what was happening to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't have, you know, what I was to later have, my music. I just had yearnings. So I went off, you know. So what do you do after a kicking in Chennai a couple of times? Well, you go to a lower level place and you start from scratch, and you, I started to get comfortable talking.
Yeah.
I started to get comfortable just, you know, the support act kind of rule book is that you go out there before the main act and you turn everything up to its maximum volume and you just flail away at the loudest volume. And that just shows passion and, God, this guy, I'm just going to listen.
Yeah, it's coming from the heart.
But actually what I found 9 times out of 10 was that if they've nothing invested in you, all you are is a very loud noise that they just rise to. So you're flailing away and their volume is actually matching you.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know what, fuck it. That just doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
So I would go out and I would not play anything.
Yeah.
And start talking.
Yeah.
And then I'd play the quietest song I could think of. And even the biggest loudmouth in the room would start to get embarrassed. The fact that all around him, somehow I was managing to get the room to just be a little gentler to me.
Yeah.
And then once I had that, I didn't kind of go to the second song and start bashing away because I haven't earned the right yet.
Yeah.
So I just kept it at that volume.
It's a pro move.
It's a pro move.
Yeah.
But I wasn't a pro.
Yeah.
So this stuff was so fragile.
And you think, like, one of the things that I'm coming to realize, and I can see the similarity between yourself and other, like, Jeff Buckley's first album, like, where there's such a sort of an array of dynamics. Like,
there's
quite louds and, you know, quite very sincere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you see, the Pixies, again and again and again, like, they... And I suppose Sonic Youth before that or whatever, but the Pixies kind of mastered the loud, loud, soft, soft.
Yeah,
they were just the masters of it.
Absolutely.
And so Jeff was in all that. Also, like his playing, his actual
sensational.
His chops are just outrageous because he was in hair bands for like 8 or 9 years. So we have this like Jeff Buckley.
What do you mean, hair bands?
Like, you know, LA hair bands.
Like
Poison.
Whitesnake.
All of that. Yeah, okay, absolutely.
Yeah. So hair bands, yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Hairspray. Yeah, hair bands, they were called.
Yeah.
Like he's from that.
Right.
So
okay.
we have this idea, Jeff, the kind of the broken winged angel who landed to us.
Pre-emo.
It just sang from a, you know, like blood-letted songs and whatever. But it wasn't like that at all. It was a fucker was in a van playing these appalling clubs like a road dog for years and gets to New York and kind of ditches the band and ditches all of that and
goes on his own way.
Well, and his own way, ironically, is his father's way.
Yeah.
You know, so he runs as far away from that as he possibly can.
I remember hearing a story, and I don't know if it's true. It's an old story, and I have to try and think about this before I get it right. Now, one of my friends, Mark Nixon, has just done a podcast with Roddy Doyle, believe it or not, and spoke about the Commitments and how that was written and where that was written. And if anyone hasn't watched The Commitments, folks, do yourselves a favor. Go on. It's a good movie. But Glenn Answered was in that movie, and I remember seeing and hearing, like, they toured the live version of that. Would have been 91, 92, probably in that era.
Yeah.
And the crazy connection between all of this was Jeff Buckley was Glenn Hansard's roadie. I don't know if this is true. Maybe you could talk to it, but the connection from Roddy Doyle sitting in a bedsit in Clontarf in Dublin to connection to Sinead, Jeff Buckley, Sinead,
Shane and Carl were very, very good at, like, if Riverdance or some big splash of an Irish thing was happening.
But was there a connection between the Sinead and Jeff Buckley?
Okay, absolutely.
So this is no longer just a bar. This is a network, a diaspora.
Well, like I was saying, the unofficial Irish embassy, this is where you went.
And
you
Jeff know. Buckley being Buckley's surname is like,
oh, absolutely.
He's Irish.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So Shane was really good at kind of getting in touch with something that was hot, that was passing through New York. And because New York, if it is hot, they are passing through. So the Commitments he nailed and said, you should come down to Sinead and sing some songs. You come down to the Village.
Crazy.
And, you know, anyone who's been in New York, there's the you know, Times Square and 42nd Street and the theater kind of world.
Yeah.
There's something very, very exciting about jumping in a cab and heading downtown.
Yeah.
You know,
to play a feels gig. A bit.
Yeah, but also, and, you know, early 90s. I had friends of mine who had never been to, wouldn't go to the East Village because it was just so
gritty.
wild west and gritty.
Yeah.
So this was exciting to them. So Glenn had met Jeff and
did you know Glenn at this stage? Is this
I knew Glenn in Dublin.
Dublin. Yeah. Okay. So around the Frames birth of 94.
Yeah. Got him before.
Yeah. 92.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember him on a Vespa, flash kit, you know, on a Vespa.
Was he ever cool?
No. He was very, passionate, and he, and what's wonderful about him is like none of that is cool. Being really kind of passionate and earnest is terribly uncool.
Yeah,
it's much cooler to be with a pair of sunglasses and sitting in the corner scoffing at everything.
Yeah.
And in the same way that Bono isn't cool, Bono wants to throw his arms around the world.
Yeah.
Tom York goes, oh my God, I'm so uncomfortable around people. Please leave me. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. You know,
but in its magic and it at its purest, there's nothing like someone throwing their arms around the world, you know?
I know. I just want to wrap up the Sinead piece a little bit more, but the authentic self is something that I hear coming through in what you're talking about, and the authentic self with
it just I'm always uncomfortable with the authentic self because it sounds so inauthentic.
I know, but from where I'm looking, it looks like
it's so neat and tidy to go, and Mark, and you did it. When an actual
but you're
fact,
doing it, I don't think it's...
Doing it. Yeah, I think I'm more comfortable with that.
Yeah, I don't think you... Yeah.
I just, like, even in the midst of, like, the happenstance of... So I got signed because I bartended.
Yeah.
And this guy would come in, and a friend of mine, this lovely woman, ironically from the Czech Republic, and the whole Marquetta, Glenn, again, with the Oscar and Once, the movie, whatever. So this girl, mad about Irish music and whatever, and she would come in. I didn't know where she worked, but she would come into the bar, and I was playing gigs by that point. I was playing my own songs in these little kind of cafes and doing good, like doing, like, I didn't have a plan. I wasn't looking for a label, or I wasn't trying to get signed. I was really writing. I think I'd done It Beats Me and Adam and Eve. I think I'd written them.
We're lucky enough that Mark has allowed us to drop some of his music in. So I just wanted to play Adam and Eve here in the middle of this episode. Let's take a little bit of a break and listen to Adam and Eve.
The payoff's on Tuesday. I'll follow the crows. There's pennies from heaven. I don't suppose. And I woke up on Thursday. Fell for the floor, and my sister's a beauty, a beauty no more. God doesn't know me or answer my call. He don't know me from Adam or Eve at all.
I was onto something. I knew that I'd said something in those songs that felt absolutely my own. And very simple songs and very there's not a whole lot I've said in them, but the melancholy, I keep talking about that word or whatever, there's a way to do it that's the sweetest McCartney kind of sweetness with all of the kind of hint of that kind of hard fought, hard won little battles or
yeah.
I'm very into that, those kind of, you know, to just cut it down to the absolute,
distill it,
just distill it to its absolute, you know, beauty or whatever. Anyway, so I had those songs and this girl had recorded them on a little cassette and she was playing it in the office. So this guy keeps coming to the bar, in the bar I'm bartending at, and then I do, I guess, a kind of a bigger gig. I was asked to play this bigger gig. And all these people from the office and the girl, this the Czech girl, and all her bosses and whatever. So they've been playing my music in this office. Mm. And they all buy tickets and they come.
Yeah.
And it turns out that this guy who comes into the bar all the time just kind of knew me as, you know, that's Mark, Irish guy, Mark, the bartender or whatever. And he goes to the gig and looks at the stage and goes, wait, what is Mark, the Irish bartender, doing when we're here to see Mark Geary?
Really?
Yeah.
You hadn't connected the two?
No, because you didn't. Because you just, you know, you go to your donut guy in the morning, or like in Seinfeld, there's the, you know, the soup Nazi. You know, he lives behind that counter. He doesn't exist anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
New York is like that. You know, you have a donut guy you go to. You get very uncomfortable if you see him in some social event somewhere else because, you know,
it's out of the norm.
It's out of your little blinkered kind of thing or whatever. Yeah. Anyway, so this guy turns out to be Gil Holland, who comes to and finds me at the bar and goes, I was at the gig last night. Fucking hell. We've been listening to you for the last 3 months on this little demo. We fucking love these songs. What can I do? What is it that you would need? And I said, I want to make a record.
Yeah.
He said, okay. So he goes off and like record label for dummies. I think he might have bought. I think such a thing exists. Yeah.
So this is how it all came about.
This is how Sonoblast happens. This is how.
Wow. So it's a lot of fortuitous events.
Like, you couldn't.
You couldn't. If it was in a movie, you think.
I couldn't plan it.
But if it was in a movie, you'd think it was too far-fetched.
But it was, it's crazy. You know, yeah, and also you would know this as a musician. Like, there is no one gig, right? Yeah. That music mythology where you go like, oh, you know, that one gig where he slayed it, killed it, and then
the deal.
Your life never is the same again.
Yeah,
my experience, and it's only my experience. I go to Italy and I go to Austria and I go to these places. The challenge is back to that challenge of the first gig and trying to win the room.
Yeah.
I just happen to have 20 years of being a road dog and a batch of songs that I can sing with such ease and such belief.
Yeah.
It's like I'm not having to prove anything, and suddenly that translates like
that's a motive.
I'm a safe pair of hands. Like, just let me, you know, let me just do the night for you, and just, you know.
And I think that's just to touch on that. That's what I mean by the authentic.
Yeah,
the piece, like, you know, it's, and when I was away and for quite a long time, there was music that I gravitated towards. And most of the stuff that's sustained in my catalogue is the authentic stuff. Yeah. The stuff that really speaks to me, not just as an expat, but just, it almost seems like lullabies, what I was saying before. Yeah. Like they're really, it's not overly complicated. And I don't mean that to be, it's not overly complicated, but it's really true. And some of the best songs, as you know, are like, you know, three chords and maybe four at the most.
Yeah.
And I feel there's some songs in there that are just going to live on for centuries. Like, one of the songs that I want to talk to you a little bit about is Obie's Chair. Okay. Mm. It's, it's something that I know when I came into you today and I was chatting to you about Obie's Cherry, you know, a big smile came on your face, like,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Talk to me about that song in particular. And also, how do you feel about that song now in the present day?
That's a huge question. I don't think about the song. I do get a smile when someone kind of responds to it. I don't listen to my albums because that would be kind of psychotic if you kind of came in setting up and I was, yeah, I can imagine. I know
like people, an Alan Partridge sketch.
I know people who do. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Listen to their own stuff and just, I had a great time today just listening to myself, you know. I hit upon a particular kind of tuning for Obie's Chair. It's just the G that I tune down.
Right.
So it changes everything as far as chords and chord shapes. Whatever.
The phrases and stuff.
And then there's a little kind of back and forth in the finger pick or whatever. And I just sat out on a fire escape on 9th Street between Avenue A and First, where I lived.
Yeah.
And I've often thought it was a bit like there's a Tom Waits record, The Heart of Saturday Night. And in one of the songs, you hear taxis and a kind of a wet kind of gravel, a tarmac or whatever. You can hear the taxi tires kind of screech and beeping and people shouting or whatever.
Yeah, I love it.
And that's what 9th Street was. It was just constant kind of back noise. Hey, fuck you, man. And hey, you know, like people telling whatever they were doing.
Yeah.
Girls laughing, all of it. So that's my soundtrack. That's my track.
Mm-hmm.
So I start playing the song and it just, so you were asking me, you know, like, so Obie's Chair, I have a son called Obie and I lugged this piece of furniture back in the middle of the night, this really cast iron chair. He hadn't been born yet and I was grappling with the notion of being a father and the notion of like what happens to me and what happens to me and is it going to be good or you know, will I be able to do it?
Yeah,
you know? And so this chair, I kept it and it stayed in the apartment and I just kept looking at it and we kept saying, well, that's Obie's chair. We decided on the name Obie. Obi-Wan Kenobi. And
was it from Star Wars?
Absolutely it was. Yeah.
I think it means love. Or
in which in from
is
whence?
It Hebrew?
Oh, okay.
I think it's,
I remember a Jewish friend of mine asked me, was it Obadiah that I was calling my son?
Yeah.
I'll try and do a double check
on
the good book. But I said, no, it's Obi-Wan, a different Bible. She was kind of horrified, but that chair is there. So it's in my conscience. I'm looking at it and whatever.
Yeah.
And then I was saying to you, I think it's a bit of a, and I have a lot of songs that are kind of love songs to New York itself. The New York that is a state of mind or an idea or a, you know, I kind of do that. I kind of write little hymnals to it, you know? So it's in the tombs where lovers meet, who curse the gods that they must seek another is a line in the song. And the tombs is where you get arrested.
Right. Okay.
The tombs is the last place you want to end up. If you've been picked up, central booking and you go to the tombs, cause you'll rot there for
a while,
a couple of weeks until your court case kind of comes up. So the tombs isn't just the tombs in a kind of an Egyptian kind of way. It's actually
a place.
Yeah.
And purgatory.
yeah. And really frightening. And I knew lots of people and there was lots of moments in my early New York days, not in my later New York days, but in my early New York days, there was possibilities that things like that could have happened.
Right.
There were kind of dark times and dark places where I that could have happened.
Yeah.
And all of the writing happens from a place that I was pretty certain it wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So it was a place of kind of in much more kind of grounded, sober,
yeah.
A sober place, a safe place.
Yeah.
So there's no surprise that my kind of sobriety and taking care of myself happens at the same time that I start writing songs that are reflective.
Okay.
And sore.
Yeah, you know? No, absolutely.
Like
the stuff that's a little bit later in opium.
Yeah.
There's a shift.
Yeah.
It's like it's not too dissimilar, but there's definitely a progression away, yeah. And there's more of a positivity, yeah. I think, in a lot of those.
Well, there's thorns. There's thorns in all of the songs, and it's a lot of the time it's distance.
Yeah.
That I'm able to. I mean, the stuff I'm writing now for the new album is all very cottage, forest, lockdown.
Mystical.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. I've been reading with a lot of, you know, not to sound like a pompous twat, but I was always frightened because I had no real kind of formal education. I was always quite frightened of Greek mythology and thought it was for the university crowd. Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. Like just to pronounce some of the stuff.
Yeah.
But Stephen, who's our boy, English comedian, Stephen Fry. Stephen Fry had the gorgeous book about the Greeks and just puts his little kind of knowing kind of stuff in it. So it reads like the EastEnders.
Yeah.
And just how rotten the gods are, you know. And then there's this woman who was a huge, huge kind of thing for me at the moment called Madeline Miller. And she has a song, two books. One is called The Songs of Achilles, where she places Patroclus, his right-hand man, as his lover, which was very common during the Greek kind of times and whatever. But it's the most beautiful love affair you've ever read.
Wow.
I mean, it's and the narration comes from the slave who's taken from Troy, and it's just so beautiful. And then her next book was Circe, and Circe gets a bit of a mention in the Odyssey. She turns sailors into pigs.
Ah.
But what Madeline does in this one is that she does a whole kind of backstory of Circe, and of course we're talking about immortals. So
yeah.
So if Zeus is pissed off at you, Zeus is gonna, you know, forever and that doesn't change
eternity.
His mind.
Yeah.
So Circe's story and the way she writes about these old myths they're so heartbreaking and
absolutely the period that you're in now in your life,
yeah.
How do you write and how has it differed from, say, 33 and a third? Like, what's the evolution of your writing process? Because there's notebooks here around us, folks, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 guitars.
Yeah.
And we're surrounded by guitars. Like,
yeah.
Is it something that you just wait for inspiration or is it something that you do daily?
Well, it's really lovely. It's really lovely to be asked. And it's really lovely that you're just sitting here. So if I can just put that down.
And then,
so of the guitars, some of them are in different tunings.
Right.
So I get out of bed, I put on the coffee, and it sounds bonkers, but fuck it. One of those guitars is, well, all of them will be played.
Yeah.
But some of them will call out to me. So I have this.
Beautiful Martin, is it? That's a Gibson.
It's an old Gibson, but it's in Nashville tuning.
Oh, yeah.
So I had it in the tuning. I went to bed and I came up and put the coffee on. Right, so that's just screaming out. There's the door open. That's what I got. I don't really know the shapes of what I'm supposed to be playing, but I found that.
Yeah.
Did I warn you There's no time that I wake you. In the blood moonlight, there's someone out there. I think you're right. And we waltz to the walls in the sacred night, the night. I'm erased again, lost without a friend. A man leads a life half blind. In the hollow we climb. Right? So I sat in all of those notebooks and just kept playing the phrase. And it felt like a sermon, or it felt like
galloping horses.
So what are you saying, Mark? What are you saying? So I had pages and pages and just kept hacking away. It was like the next bit. I want water, I want wine, I want the poison in my veins to work this time. Like, just wow.
So you go for quantity and lyrics, and you write pages.
In this one I did. Not always. It just felt like exactly as you said, galloping.
Yeah.
But like, you're only gonna gallop with me if you're into what I'm saying to you.
Yeah.
But like, I want the poison in my veins to work this time. That's fucking heavy.
That's a big
you
one.
Know, like, wow, what's this fucker at? But let's keep going.
Yeah.
I'm with you. Whatever this gallop is, I'm curious, you know?
And I think it's important for people to realize when you've been hit with those kind of thunderbolts.
Yeah.
Do you put the guitar down at that point, or what do you do? Do you stop and say, well, that's enough for one day, and then come back to it? Or do you just keep with it?
Well, that was over the course of, I mean, you know, however long your heart rate has increased and you're scribbling, and that first, like, maybe you get lucky, maybe you get a verse.
Yeah.
If I can get I've certainly got a verse, and I've certainly got a tag at the end, the hollow. And the hollow took a long time to find. I was trying to place it in the thing, like, where am I?
Yeah.
I'm on a gallows. I'm being hung. I'm a prisoner.
It's from other year though. That sound is.
Well, it's Americana.
You know, 1800s.
Well, that's exactly. It's exactly right. So okay. So we're in the 1800s now. It's dusty and it's uprising and it's rebellion and but I'm being hung on the gallows. Yeah. You know.
Here's a question for you now. Yeah. Like, that guitar is, I don't know, it's probably 50 years older.
Yeah.
You know, it's a Gibson. How does it differ, that Nashville tuning? And how important is it that guitar is in that tuning versus these other ones over here? I think there's a Martin and a Takamine.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that I find, and I've got multiple guitars as well.
Yeah.
Some guitars just feel different in certain chords.
Yeah. Well, the Martin has been my workhorse for...
It's famous to any Irish fans of Irish music.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't make them anymore. It's a 000. And I've never been... Like, during the lockdown, I kind of went a bit mad because there was no gigs.
Yeah.
And I really only had, like, one guitar. I only ever had one guitar.
Right.
And it was the Martin. It was that 000.
And so these are recent acquisitions then?
Fairly recent. But with the what I loved, and I bought a piano. I've been learning, teaching myself how to play piano.
Yeah.
So with the Nashville, like, as opposed to, God, wouldn't it be lovely to have a Nashville guitar and just see what you could do? Why not just have a Nashville that's in that tuning? So for the listeners, what you do is that you take all of the high strings off a 12-string guitar.
Yeah.
And you put all it, so they're all these chiming, and you said it during when we were talking about Obi's Chair and Adam and Eve and whatever. Like, I write at night a lot of the time, or I sing to myself at night. So there's a lullaby quality just by, I'm maybe being a little quieter. My heart rate is lower. Actually, physically. Your heart rate kind of slows down at night, you know. So you're just sitting, the fire's on and whatever. And I don't want to paint this kind of like you know, Mark the aesthetic or Mark the hermit or whatever. Like, I'm as bonkers as just about everyone else. But I, to answer your original question about, like, what do I know now that I maybe didn't when I was trying to write songs for 33 and a third? My awareness of that, that's something stay with it, I think, has absolutely magnified.
Yeah.
That I would have never stayed with a song like the one I just knocked out to you.
Over a period of time.
I couldn't have, because my attention span as a rabbit, you know.
Yeah.
I just wouldn't have, I wouldn't have seen it through, and I wouldn't have trusted my own sleuthness. I wouldn't have been able to find the little bits and the clues and the magic.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have seen them.
Yeah. You weren't experienced enough.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so. So that's what's changed. And
you mentioned there about when you wake up in the morning,
yeah,
one of these guitars is gonna
see what they have. Do they have something to say?
Yeah, absolutely. You know? And that's almost, it's very religious in a certain way. Like, you know, like
I'm so aware of that. I mean,
you know what I mean?
I honestly say that I'm a musician, but it's because of vocation.
Mm.
You know, it's just what I do.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, and I don't know about the world we live in and how you experience it. But for me as a musician now, when I go to the airport with my guitar on my back and all of my pedals, I'm like a snail. I'm just bringing the shit to on tour.
Yeah.
And they're big shows and they're tiny shows and they're let's go and tour and see, hope for the best. And it's all of that.
Yeah.
There isn't just a level that I do. But my question to you was I honestly feel that actually my life, not me just as a musician, whatever, is a form of kind of like civil disobedience.
Mm.
It's because I don't work for anyone.
Yeah.
I don't answer to anyone. I don't wake up in the morning and have 15 emails.
Yeah.
Could you just knock that out and we'll do a meeting and we'll do the, and people can say, well, you lucky bastard. And they're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But they can also say, like, that's insane. Or would you not feel like making money? Would you not feel like, you know, that would you get a nicer car, get a blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
My civil disobedience is like, this is completely what it is.
Mm.
And that's happened over 20 years as well. It's not just music. So I can show up with these songs that I absolutely like. I still play Adam and Eve. It's part of a set.
Yeah.
And it's a card. It's a color. Final goodbye to everyone where I've won the gig.
Yeah.
It's a celebration. That's what that song has turned into.
Yeah.
Like, how did I know that was ever going to happen? You don't. You have no idea.
You wouldn't have when you created it, but just touching on the religious thing a little bit more, like I noticed on the way down in the car here that there is some mentions of Holy Mary.
Oh, I do it all the time.
And
yeah, I'm a recovering Catholic.
Yeah, like all of us. Yeah. It's and I hadn't really heard it.
Yeah.
It's like I must have listened to that album, as I said, like, you know.
Well, his God doesn't know me or answer my call in Adam and Eve. There's
a
Hail
that's
Mary.
Such a big lyric, like, you know, like.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
I mean, I think to give people who aren't Irish, to give them some sort of context, what it was like, you know, you're probably schooled in the 80s, like myself, like, you know. It was kind of drilled into us.
It was unavoidable.
Yeah, you couldn't get away from this stuff.
I mean,
you know?
It was just like you picked it up. You picked up phrases and whether you believed it or not, like you're asleep at mass. You're just trying to. You're either too hot or too cold. You're just rocking yourself and willing it to end.
Yeah,
like there's
I
no.
I do remember that.
There's no uplifting sermon because it's all done in such a monotone and miserable and kind of a bit dour and, you know.
Yeah.
So there's the kind of Presbyterian almost in that, you know.
Yeah, just the sort of the procession
yeah,
of just going with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, and but But then, you know, the stained glass windows, the incense, the
rituals,
the pageantry of it all, or whatever, whether you believe it or not, and the guy kind of, and the body of Christ and whatever, it just gets in. And also as a writer,
yeah,
it's it permeates. But it's so provocative.
Yeah.
It's as powerful as I want the poison in my veins to work this time. Like the God doesn't know me or Hail Mary or it just, they just have a, they have a kind of a spark to those yeah. words when you land it. Not that I'm trying to do them on purpose.
No.
Actually, they just pop out there.
Absolutely. But it's funny because the lullabyic, if you want to, I don't know if that's a phrase even, but the style of music that yeah. seems to gravitate back to us.
Yeah.
And I have found myself, this is crazy, like, yeah. and I'm not religious at all, like, yeah. you know, humming stuff from my childhood, sure. that was kind of, we'd sing it in mass.
Well, you know the way the Jesuits would say, you know, give us a child from the age of seven and we'll give you the man.
Right, okay.
That was a thing. That was a thing, and that was a boast for them. Now,
wow.
If I think of that and I think of my own children, I would think, well, I would keep you away from yeah. any seven-year-old that I could think of.
Yeah.
You know? Because they knew that as that little brain is forming, you get them at that age or whatever.
And they're hooked.
Completely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Completely.
But those songs that we all probably, in Ireland anyway, were kind of brainwashed into singing like yeah. as school children.
Yeah.
They were very catchy.
Yeah.
And they were in some way moving. And,
But also, you know, like to get out of classrooms and into an assembly. And yeah. if you want to sit here with me for 3 hours and we'll sing hymns and we'll go through the Catholic kind of songbook, I'm down to do that. Just don't bring me back into the classroom and have me listen about Peg or some boring
stuff.
Just terrible stuff. So of course, it's attractive.
I
get asked about it a lot, and it's always surprising to me. But I think it's exactly as you say. I just think it gets in there, and. Like I'm figuring it out, or maybe yeah. this is a way to kind of wash it out that yeah. I can actually write it down and whatever, because but I'd have no formal religion or whatever, but get me out into the forest there. I'll bring you out for a little wander and
have a look.
Yeah, I mean get me out there and I can think all kinds of notions.
Yeah,
I have no fixed point.
Yeah, like I think most people in Ireland are probably
yeah
in a similar place. Like,
I think
yeah. What's the future looking like now? Because I notice, you know, it's really rooty. You've got the piano in the corner here over here.
Yeah.
You're still signed with Sonoblast, and you've got this album's coming out next year.
Yeah.
When can we expect that out? And also, what are you up to in the next say 6 months?
Well, I'm going to do, so next week in Whelan's in Dublin,
yeah,
I'm going to do this residency. So there's 5 weeks, there's 5 shows. Who knew that there were 5 weeks
in Whelan's?
In Whelan's. Like who knew there was 5 weeks in a November, but that's what it turns out. So every Wednesday I'm going to do a show, and I've been asked to kind of, I thought it might be nice to curate each week. So to be a different band, a different support act,
yeah.
Different guests and different songs each week.
Wow, that's a lovely idea.
You know, so they exist completely by themselves,
yeah.
like each kind of thing. So that challenges me to, not that I'd lean on one particular thing or another, but really kind of focuses me on okay, so this week I'm gonna, so it might be a trad band. I might have a trad band, and then nice. It'd be. For the first 2 shows, I have a lot of singers. So I just adore, you know, and it goes back to that moment of maybe when you were at Whelan's with us. If a room starts singing.
Yeah.
Like,
And that room is special as well.
Yeah, but any room, honestly, that is involved in you know, just the voices actually singing a melody, yeah, a room doing it. Like, it doesn't matter how loud a band is. It doesn't matter how hooky those guitar parts are, or the bass, or the, you know, the drum solo. There is nothing that attracts me more.
Yeah.
Than 2 and 3. You know, I was watching the Beatles Get Back for the 8th time, and like when the 3 of them are singing,
magic. Yeah.
It's just,
I know.
You know, it's outrageous musicianship.
Yeah.
It is. Lottery winner on top of lottery winner on top of, you know. And so I had this idea. So there's a girl called Megan O'Neill, beautiful piano player, has her own career. So she's coming to play and sing on the songs. And then Ellen O'Reilly, a bass player. So these are interesting kind of people too, because they've come from a later Dublin than I, a later Ireland. And studied in BIM and kind of notation and music chops and music degrees and whatever. And then went to London to hustle.
Yeah.
So they come from a world of kind of, they can be very comfortable, you know, the session
musicians,
top liners in sessions, creating songs, making hit records and whatever.
Yeah.
And then rejecting it and going like, actually,
this doesn't work because of this.
It doesn't work because I might as well be in Microsoft making components.
Yeah,
I'm not really invested in it. The musicianship and the chops I'm very interested in.
Yeah,
but the pop song made to order just doesn't
and do
it's
it
never
it.
Done. But spend a week in a car together and let's listen to Top 40, and I guarantee you. We'll have our favorite pop songs because it's crack cocaine for ears.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's designed that
it's
way.
McDonald's food.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And we'll get into the car and you'll hear it 4 times a day.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if you like it or not. But by the end of it, we'll be singing our Taylor Swift's and all the rest of it, killing it, singing
absolutely.
Away, you know. But it's not the music I listen to, and it's not the music that sustains me in any way or whatever.
Yeah. Well, they say, what is it? Music is food for the soul.
Mm.
And I mean, you've got a choice of what food you put into your body, and
I think people, you know, the people in the know, or the people in power, or the people who are looking to sell something, they know that music is the thing that's going to sell it.
Yeah,
more than any picture, more than any kind of slick little video, or whatever. A catchy little something is just going to...
It's still very powerful.
Well, yeah, we've been doing this, you know, like the Americans figured that out a long time ago. Just a catchy jingle.
Yeah.
It was going to sell your product, you know.
Well, look, Mark, if people want to reach out to you and listen to your music and buy your music, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, to listen, they can do Spotify. The new song, there's one, The Forest and Spectre are the two songs from the new album. And so there's Bandcamp, and get in touch with me. I'm on Instagram and whatever.
You're on everywhere.
I'm everywhere. And then, you know, if you're in Ireland, you know, come to Pick a Wednesday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pick a Wednesday.
I'll be there anyway. At least one of them.
Great.
Mark, thanks so much for your time.
Jerry, a pleasure. Really lovely.
So there you have it, folks. If you got this far in the conversation, thank you so much for listening. You can check out more of our episodes on thisis8cd.com. And if you want to support the network, you can subscribe and become a patron for as little as €1.66 per month. See you in the next episode.
stop.